Hi, everybody. I'm Graham Reside, and I'm going to be leading our conversation today about this is a really about developmental theory and the stages of development. I have the wrong pedagogical tool here in PowerPoint for a group of four people, five people, but we can have a conversation nonetheless. As I said, my name is Graham. I teach at Vanderbilt Divinity School, and I also do leadership development, and this is out of my work in leadership development. I have been a child, I sometimes still feel like a child, and I have two children. So I have an investment in this notion of development as well. So that's my welcome. I wanted to read from you from the Gospel of John, chapter 10, verses 7 to 10. Listen for the word of the Lord. So again, Jesus said to them, "Very truly I tell you, I am the gate for the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and bandits, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters by me will be saved, and will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I come that they may have life and have it abundantly." So I like that notion of abundant life, and I'm trying to connect it up with this notion of generativity, which is the sort of focus of our conversation today. So just to go over, our objective for today is to understand within this sort of general theory of human development, which is funded really by Piaget's notion of cognitive development, Kohlberg's notion of moral development. Jim Fowler then applied that notion to faith development, and others have applied it to emotional development too. So, but they all have a general, Eric Erickson also is very much interested in psychological development, so they all are very much interested in mapping out in general terms and schematic terms how it is that human beings develop over a lifetime. And I wanted to talk about this. And generativity, or the generative stage of development, is a term that Eric Erickson first introduced, and that's what I'd like us to start at the end as a way of pulling ourselves forward as we think about development, to start with a vision or a picture of what generative development looks like. So that's the purpose of this evening. Understanding generativity as a mode of being in the world. And I try to connect it up in my own work to, with the notion of vocation. That our vocation, what God calls us to do and be, is to be fully generative and engaging. And so that's for tonight. But over the course of the week, as a kind of advertisement, I'm going to work on the larger issue of development and work across all the stages. So that's what's in store. I work on the general assumption that all the wisdom we need is already in the room, so I will be asking you all to reflect with me, and I'll try to gather what your insights into this topic. Okay, so that leads me to my first request of you, which is to think about for a second a time in your life when you were engaged in a project, or it could be a relationship, but more ideally a project in which you were really good. Just take a moment to think of a project that you were engaged in where you were really good. And I'll give you an example from my own life. And then what I'd like you to do is just come up with a headline that you can share with another person. So this is a bit of foolishness as part of the theme for the week. So for me, I was at a conference, and one of my colleagues came down with laryngitis and couldn't speak. And so I was asked to pinch hit. So I had to kind of come up with something to say and say it before, you know, a couple hundred people on very short notice. And it was, you know, one of the times in my life where I felt like, wow, that really went well. I felt like I really was effective, and I was powerful, and things were good. So my sort of headline for that would be, Reside pinch hits on lecture and hits a home run. Okay, so I'm asking you to think of something in your life where you've been engaged and you felt like yeah, it really went well, and what you might want to say in a headline. And I'll even give you the first line of my article because I enjoyed this so much. The first line would be, if they gave Nobel Prizes for lectures, Reside wins for 2006. All right. So just take a minute, and I'm going to ask some questions about it. But first think about what your headline might be, and be prepared. I'll ask you to share some of them. And then we'll ask these questions. What were you like? How did you think, feel, and get things done in the moment? And what did you need? How did you deal with problems? You don't have to answer all these questions, but I'm going to try to collect some of these things. And how would others have described you in that moment? What qualities described you? Oops. So those are some of the questions. So anyone come up with a headline yet? It doesn't have to be as good as mine. I had more time to think about it. Or maybe you didn't think mine was all that good. Any headlines for... Yes?
HDS Bruce, the Attorney General's Office in record time.
What did you say?
Company moved Texas Attorney General's data center in record time.
Moves Attorney General's office?
Data center.
Data center. Oh, that's Attorney General. Any others? Okay. Mr. Cobb?
Hair-raising zip line installed in the West End.
Okay, any others?
15 started, didn't lose one.
15 started?
15 hit on Monday, didn't lose one.
All right. Sake of brevity, will that do? None lost. Anyone else? Yes.
DC Miler.
DC Miler.
DC Miler captures mile relay after dropped baton. That stands for Denver Christian.
Captures a mile relay. Wow.
After dropped baton.
Were you on the team, or were you coaching it? Or?
I was the anchor running it.
Great. Any others?
Maniac woman calmly welcomes daughter.
Those are enough to get started unless someone else feels they really want to share their headline. Get in print while you can. It's a small circulation though. So I want to capture then what were some of the qualities that you had when you were in this state? Right? If I could sort of, if we could borrow from athletics, athletes talk about being what? In the
zone.
In the zone. And there's a guy, Mikhail. Mihail Csikszentmihalyi, who wrote a book called The Flow State. He writes about the flow state. So it's also, sometimes people talk about it being in the flow state. But I'm interested in learning or thinking about what are the qualities of personhood, character, when one is in this situation. Any
enthusiasm.
Ideas? Sorry?
Enthusiasm.
Does this go both ways?
Want some more paper?
I can grab one right here. So we have enthusiasm. What else? Just shout it out and I'll capture them.
How about focused calm?
Determination.
Oh. Anything else? You shout them out. Any qualities?
Planning.
Sorry?
Planning.
Planning. So it's thoughtful? You mean like it's been...
It's been planned.
It's been planned. Okay?
Confident.
Confident. Others?
Utter brilliance.
Kind of a positive expectation. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like confidence, only you think you might get lucky. Some good things might be happening that you aren't causing to happen just because you're in that zone. Huh. So there must be sincerity, serendipity.
Anything else? So, you're willing to risk things, to trial and error, make mistakes?
Yeah. Okay.
Right. Risk taking. Trial and error. Anything else?
Get execution.
Execution. What else were you like when you're at your very best?
Well, the word that comes to mind in my case was pumped. Pumped.
Pumped. One that's important.
Energetic.
Sorry?
Energetic.
I also think you're needed. I mean, there has to be the situation. There's a context to it, right? Yeah.
There's enthusiasm.
Enthusiastic
goes in that same.
Yeah.
Yes.
So a sense of being needed. I mean, if I can add, sort of think that it's purposeful, right? That there's a purpose to our work. That somehow it rises above the what feels like the routine every day, and there's something special about it. And
inspired.
Sorry?
Inspired. Yeah,
inspired.
That's what you're saying, is being redundant.
And inspired, of course, means to be breathed into, right? Anything else? One for me is creativity, that I feel creative and I don't feel anxious. I feel creative. And if I can, again, I feel a certain kind of freedom to experiment, to try things.
Give life to.
Life giving. Okay, so. We can see that we could go on and on, but these are, I want to suggest, qualities that do, in fact, define in some ways adults when they are operating out of a generative mode. Now, the challenge is, why are we not always operating out of a generative mode? And that seems to be the difficulty, at least for me. And one of the things that this theory suggests is that while we think we are dealing with adults all day, right. We think, in fact, we're dealing with children at different stages in development over the course of the day. And whenever I tell this in a group of a lot of people, there's a lot of nodding. But the other part of it is that we ourselves are acting as children for a variety of reasons over the course of the day. And so thinking about developmental theory in that larger sense of how we ourselves get triggered into these stages, earlier stages, and how can we grow up in the moment and live out of a more generative space more often? That is, I want it to be the curriculum for this week, is to think about how can we live out of our sense of generativity more often. All right, so let me get back to my inappropriate tool for this group.
The group's growing, so it's
Yeah, it's growing. I was saying, well, there's only four people when I first got here, so I said it's not really the ideal.
It's kind of
tool.
Generative.
Yeah. Okay. So if we think about generativity, I've tried to get you to sort of name some of these things already. But if we think of what if we think about it in terms of how do we think when we are generative, one thing that we might say is we tend to be more dialectical in our thinking. So we're able to have both and notions in our thinking and not as restrictive. Our very thinking, it's a kind of expansiveness, right? To be generative is to be in some ways expansive, that we can think in a both and or a dialectical way, and we can be self-reflective. Which, as we'll see over the course of the week, that's harder to do, and in fact, is unable to do. A child is unable, for example, to engage in this kind of thinking. And when we ask them to engage in this kind of thinking, we're asking too much of them. And our own colleagues can at times, if they're triggered back into an earlier stage, be unable to think with us dialectically. And the challenge is, how can we get them to come?
Well, like if they're under stress.
Exactly. Well, tired, stress, or anxiety are the things. I'm not sure why that happened. Okay, and so in the feeling, how does one feel in a state of generativity? Empathetic, curious, and congruent. That one is able to feel true feelings. And I think when you're with someone who feels generative, you sense that their feelings are real. But other people, their feelings sometimes feel a little inauthentic. They don't feel quite right to the moment or the event. And in terms of the needs of generative people, their fundamental needs are about meaning and purpose. And this will, I think, be shown to be different in other stages. Their needs are around service and vocation, equality and liberation. And we can compare this, by way of preview, to a kind of more narcissistic need, right, to feel special. And so there's a concern for integration and wholeness. And the way that they, by power I mean, how do people get things done? Right? Or how do they act upon other people? They're not manipulative, but in fact they accept the strengths and limitations of others. They see the situation as it really is. And there's a sense of shared purpose, empathy, honesty, and integrity. So these are, in general sense, the descriptions of the generative stage of life. And I think that we live in a world that's in need of generative leaders. And so I'd ask you to think, who are your heroes? Who are the kinds of people that have changed the world for you? They don't have to be famous people. They can be intimates. But my guess is they will be people that have generative capacities, or the way in which they have moved you or moved the world is because of their generativity.
Just think of Nelson Mandela.
That's the same I was going to say.
I don't even know how he survived, but he moved mountains. It was unbelievable. So in the prison cell, he must have been generative for dozens of years.
Anyone else have anyone that they would put up there as one of their heroes?
Gorbachev.
Is this idea of being generative something that comes and goes at certain times in a person's life?
Yeah.
Or is it exhibited in certain areas in a person's life?
Yeah, I want to hold this up as a kind of lure, right? Like something that's always calling us forward and calling our children or our students, whomever that we engage, that it's calling us forward into a way of life that none of us are generative all the time. And
right,
in fact,
right,
if we read the autobiographies or the biographies of MLK or Nelson Mandela, in fact, they're rife with instances of less than generative behavior. But the notion that one can be drawn and moved by this, it is in a sense a normative ethic, that this is how we want to be. But this is an important book by Robert Keegan, who's a psychologist actually. It's called In Over Our Heads, The Complexities of Modern Life, I think that's what it's called. And his argument is that as modern life becomes increasingly complex, the mental demands of modern life are increased, and yet we're not growing up people who are capable to handle those increased mental demands. And I would say, not just mental demands, but moral demands, spiritual demands, that we need people who are more generative in order to more fully engage the modern world. So the complexities of modern life demand generative people. Imagine how powerful and efficacious our institutions could be if people were generative more often, and including, I might say, our churches. Imagine how powerful our churches could be if we, as members or leaders, were ourselves more generative more often, and if all the members of our congregation were that way. So it's a kind, I hold this, I started with this one because I think it's a very powerful and promising notion. That if folks, to the degree that we can think about and live out of our generative giftedness, we can really make a difference in the world. Okay, we could stop and let me get your thoughts on this and feedback, and then what I wanted to do next is think about how we develop more generally. Let's take a few minutes to get your feedback on, or your responses to this notion of generativity.
I think one of the things that resonated with me was the talking about a personal contribution to the good of a larger group. Mm-hmm. So that you recognize you played a role, but where your real reward was not in your personal benefit, but in the benefit of a larger group.
Well, if we think of even just the term generous, generativity, it has the same root as generous. It has the same root as generations, right? So it's a commitment, in some ways, to something beyond oneself, right? Mm-hmm. And I know in my own life that the best antidote to my own narcissism has been being a generative, actually being a father, right? Having children who don't really care about my needs. So this notion of generativity,
yeah, that's pretty
much nothing personal, honey, I don't even care. She's learning as she gets older to attend to her father's needs, but it's not appropriate, right? I should be attending to her needs, and I actually found that a quite freeing sense. But we all have relationships where we can be generative. But yes, even the word itself implies a certain creativity. A birthing of something new.
It's Genesis.
Genesis, even the word Genesis, right? Thank you.
I think with regard to child raising, I've sometimes used the phenomenon you referred to as at one perspective on original sin, that a child is not supposed to take care of our needs. Mm-hmm. We're to take care of theirs. But we do that with the hope that they will absorb that and become self-sufficient, self-confident, etc., so that they can be generative. Because if they get to age 25 and we're still taking care of all their needs, we've created a sick personality, a degenerate, I suppose. One of them.
Anyone else? Well, let me share with you a little bit about the way I've been thinking about human development, and it's really mixing together both psychodynamic notions of development and this sort of stage notion of development. Because while it is true that we develop in stages, right, you have to learn how to do simple math before you can do complicated math, which I never learned, or I would know the more technical term than complicated math. But we learn in stages, right? And so certain operations have to come first. And with our children, we see this too. They have to develop a certain an understanding of fairness, really, before they can understand a notion of justice. So it's actually appropriate that first they learn that half of the pie is mine, before they can start to think about distributing pie to everybody, for example. So we learn in a kind of modal stage. But it's also true that we have our unique scripts, our unique stories that we bring to our own development. When I say how do we develop, scripts and stages is the language I use. And by scripts, that means the particular stories of our lives, right? So scripts are the systems of beliefs about ourselves, about other people, and about life that we get from our particular cultural context. And it might be that we grew up with the notion that I can do it if I try. Other people will take advantage of me, or other people will not take advantage of me. That these are sort of basic storylines that we take on as we grow up and bring into our development. You know, it might be that you grew up with the notion that life is full of opportunities, or maybe you grew up with the notion that life is full of challenges, uncertainty, or disappointments. And you, if those are basic scripts of your lives, you tend to bring them, or we tend to bring them, into every relationship that we have, every engagement that we have, and every stage of development that we have. So these beliefs, these fundamental beliefs that we pick up in our primary relationships, become deep structures for our lives, and they are often, these are often laid down early, and that's why if you go to therapy, you end up talking about your family. Right? Because these are the early relationships that lay down the patterns, the core symbols and beliefs of, that we have, that we take on about our lives, and we bring them into the world. So out of our particular experiences and beliefs, we make decisions about who we will be and not be, what we will be and not be, what we will do and not do, to achieve the results we want to achieve.
Well, and along with that would be, do we have the power and the permission to shape our lives?
Do we have the
power and the permission to shape our lives? I mean, is that something that is, that we have a possibility of doing that? Or do we live in an environment where our own efforts are not acknowledged or respected or whatever?
Now, are you, I find that particularly interesting. I'm a sociologist, so I'm wondering, are you saying that in terms of the stories that we get, or actually the institutional limits that some people live under?
Oh, probably some of both. I get, I'm coming, I lived 7 years behind the Herald curtain, and I taught high school to kids who in the past didn't have control over their lives and had sort of learned that there's no point trying to. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, the Slovak language does not, it did not have a word for to plan. Because they had been under the rule of other empires for 1,000 years, and it was, it made no point. There was no point in planning.
Right. So in fact, the story you're saying, the script that they had, was structured not just by their family life, but by
the culture,
very society
situation
in which they lived. Yes, I think that's true. And then it actually becomes nothing but a source of frustration if they were to try to live differently.
Or you learn to deceive in order to get what you want.
So I'm starting with this notion of script and saying that we have these core beliefs about ourselves that come both from the sort of institutional arrangements of our lives and also our family situation, the experiences we have early on, that give a kind of emotional texture and create a set of dispositions in us. And then I want to couple this with this developmental model that I'm going to be talking about over the course of the week. And here, again, human beings go through a sequential process in our development, generally from simple to complex operations, both emotionally, cognitively, and we can think spiritually in terms of our faith development. But our scripts interact with our development and can trigger us to particular levels of thinking, feeling, and responding. And this again is where I talked about the father who was overbearing. We could pick any number of possibilities. If one grows up with an overbearing father who's highly critical, then one hears criticism from others, one may not respond generatively, but feel defensive and find themselves back in that stage of a six-year-old being criticized again, right? So imagine what it's like trying to manage a staff or engage another person, whether it's an intimate or on the job. You don't realize that your statements may be, not because of anything that you've done, but triggering them back to another stage in their life, quite understandably. It can be helpful to know about these stages, and also to see how people behave in these stages, so that when you see a certain kind of response, you can think, oh, they seem to be triggered. I've triggered them. There's something in this event that's triggered them back. Again, stress, anxiety, or tiredness are natural triggers when we're not at our best. And the last thing I would say is that human beings actually develop pretty easily up to about 21, right? I mean, and after that, it takes a bit of effort. That's why we have spiritual directors. That's why we go to therapy. That's why, you know, that's why self-help bookshelves are some of the, you know, most robust and some of the highest selling volume. Because it actually takes effort to develop past the age of 21. And yet again, as I, the Robert Keegan book suggests, in an increasingly complicated and complex world, both in terms of relationships, in terms of expertise that we need to continue to develop past 21. And we have seen, again, as a sociologist, it's I think it's interesting, the prolonging of childhood, or at least of adolescence. I'm 44, and I'm just about ready to move out of adolescence. So I think this is a kind of common extension or of childhood.
But society also pushes that early, so the period of adolescence has gotten much longer over time. Because it seems like, as a culture, children are pushed, for whatever reason.
You mean at the front end?
Yeah, the front end as well. I mean, so adolescence has gone from, you know, whatever to...
Yeah. What's the definition of adolescence?
I was just using it in terms of, in terms of a stage, a developmental stage, is when you first become conscious that the world is looking at you, that you have consciousness of the other. Yeah, I think that's a general notion of adolescence. That it's when you become an adolescent, well, again, we'll talk about it this week, but that's when you start to be on the phone all the time to make sure that everything's okay with everybody. Because you become aware that you are now part of a social system, and oh my goodness, everyone's looking at me, and I'm looking at them. And the problem is you haven't yet developed an autonomous self. You've developed a social self, but not an autonomous self.
So Facebook and MySpace is just like quantum that.
That's right.
Looking at me, looking at everybody else, looking at me.
And another way in which you can always be in communication, always be measuring others' emotional responses to you.
Yeah. And you separate from your parents.
Well, I put that at a later stage, actually.
But I mean, the process starts, right. And so the parents start going crazy, for good reason.
For good reason.
But does development past 21 take effort because of responsibility and things you got to do, or because of the fact that it's a defined age?
I didn't pick the age, but I didn't. It could have been a different age, but I think if you just think about again, in our social situation, we have formal education. There's a sense that we train people, we form them up to about 21, 22, but that is becoming prolonged because as a college degree is no longer, you know, enough for a lot of folks, that adolescence extends. So the formal development of people goes up to 21, and then I'm just suggesting trying to be a little bit tongue-in-cheek or funny, that after that you have to try to do it yourself, right? Or find ways. You have to be a little more intentional. And again, I think church is a great place for formation.
Something I read the other day was talking about how in our Western society we have our sense of development is that, you know, we're developing up until about age whatever, 21, 22, and then from about that age to 60 is all the same. And it's so, you know, there's not a lot of formal information or education out there that says that once you hit adulthood, there are many more stages yet to come. And people are, you know, just kind of stuck thinking, okay, well, I'm 22. I'm done growing. All done. You know, and some people are still, you know, stuck like that. It's a lifetime of work.
Well, I am reminded that, you know, different societies have different ways of thinking about that. So in India, you do have a stage where after you are a householder, you have, there's another stage that you can go on to, which is you leave your home behind and you go off into a kind of pilgrimage or a spiritual development that one goes on alone.
Right, it's like, yeah, into the woods or something.
Okay, so in this developmental stages model, how many stages are there? Well, they're all made up anyway. So Eric Erickson describes 8 stages. Lawrence Kohlberg has 6, and he proposes a 7th, right? Then Kohlberg, again, is moral development. So Kohlberg is looking at how people, how particularly with young people, children, develop a moral sensibility. And again, it goes from a kind of general sense of fairness, that is what's most important, to a sense of justice and even compassion that comes later. And it's one of his famous experiments is the Heinz experiment, where he asks these children, there's a man whose wife is dying, and she has to get a drug, and he has no money. And is it okay for this man to steal the drug? And the children, at a kind of conventional level, where the law is all of morality, say no, you cannot. But as they once they get to a certain age, and it's usually around 14, 15, they can start to think, no, they should, he should steal that. Right? And then when they get even more creative, they say, oh, it's not a forced option, it's not one or the other. Mm-hmm. There's something else, there are other options. And again, that's a generative sense, that there may be other possibilities here. I got sidetracked. Kohlberg has 6 or 7 stages. James Fowler, the book on faith development, has 6 stages. It's a book called Stages of Faith. If you're not familiar with it, it's pretty, groundbreaking, Brad, would that be the right word? In faith development. Sorry?
It's a classic.
Yeah, it's a classic. But I'll propose 5 stages.
Get down lower, I'll be able to remember.
Right.
You have to get down lower. Yes. So you can gain a higher stage.
You're fine.
Okay, so the 5 stages are first enforcer stage, 0 to 3. And I'll talk about these more in depth over the course of the week.
So these are ages, the numbers you have?
Yes. No, it's in every group. There's usually 0 to 3 enforcers. No, it's age. Scorekeeper, I'll give you a little preview. In an enforcer, you think, how do they think? Well, they don't think, they think episodically. It's what's here now. Right? So they find it hard to concatenate, to join past and present. So I have a 3-year-old, and for her, there's only 3 times. Today, yesterday, and tomorrow. So everything that happened in the past is yesterday. And everything that may happen in the future is tomorrow, and then there's everything right now. So, you know, it's the frustration of, can we go swimming? And I say, in 5 minutes. And 6 seconds later, can we go swimming? Because there is 5 minutes, not in her cognitive frame yet. In terms of, at the enforcer level, why we call it enforcer, how do they get their needs met? Well, when they don't get what they want, they scream, or they leave. So it's fight or flight. And so it's an enforcer stage when an adult acts this way. And what's their basic need? Survival. Their basic need is survival at this stage. So if you if a corporation is going to let someone go, right? Often the security guard sees them out.
Yeah.
Because you are most likely to rage and go to an enforcer mode when you feel like your very survival is at stake. So again, we refer to it as enforcer. And it's not a pretty thing for adults to go enforcer. Scorekeeping is this sense that there's a limited number of goods and I want to get mine. You know? At its best, I'll take half the pie, you take half the pie. But at its worst, it's sneakiness in order to get a little bit more of the pie. The 11 to 17, again, these are somewhat arbitrary numbers, but you may be able to see them in when you think about childhood development. This is the notion of peacekeeping, that you become aware that you are part of a society, a clan, a group, a clique. And what you want to do is make sure everybody's getting along. And again, adults, this often, I won't just say in churches, but in most organizations, peacekeeping is the dominant cultural mode. Let's just get along.
Conflict avoidance. Northwest nice.
Northwest nice.
Northwest nice. I
Yes, sir.
I have a question of peacekeeping. Can you say a little more about that? Because I don't think of a 13-year-old particularly as interested in keeping everybody happy. That they're often the ones who are disruptive, you know, or pushing back against authority, parental authority, right, or other kinds of authority in order to sort of individuate. How does that fit into peacekeeping?
I'd be interested in what the other folks have to say. I don't have a 13-year-old. I have a 3-year-old. But, and I have an 8-year-old, but it seems to me, I think we overestimate how autonomous our early teenagers are. I think they still really want their parents' approval, but really, the other thing is this is about peer group. So they may be starting to differentiate from family, but they're not going to an autonomous sensibility. They're actually going to another group.
Yeah.
Other than the family.
That makes,
so that makes universal peacekeeping. It's not local.
Social.
It's
right. About social circle.
A lot of insider-outsider stuff.
Yeah. If something blows up, I mean, that's what everybody's talking about until it reaches a new equilibrium.
Right.
Because I have an 18. We've just been in this forever.
So it's well, being
and it has nothing to do with you, but you're caught in the crossfire of whatever's going on.
So you're finding that those 11 to 17 years is a lot longer than the 17 minus 6.
Yeah, I agree. I would never call that peacekeeping, but I see
it. Well, it's high drama. It is high drama.
It's way high drama.
Is this also a kind of peer group approval thing? I mean, of wanting the peer group to have a kind of homeostasis to it so that I'm comfortable within that, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's
unique just like everybody else.
It serves an important social function,
yeah,
right, to keep groups cohesive.
Right. Right, so they don't kill each other, which they could.
Been there,
right.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, testosterone is starting to rage, right? So if you didn't have a high focus on peacekeeping, I can imagine the kinds of outcomes.
And the gangs do kill each other.
Right. Okay, so rebel producing, this is, again, you're now rebelling. You're rebelling against all social institutions, and nobody knows anything. This is where your parents don't know anything, but neither do your professors. Nobody knows anything except you. And actually, they make great employees because they're highly productive, because it's what they want to do is be competent and prove their autonomy and individuality in the world. Again, a fairly arbitrary set of numbers, but I think in rough outline they work. So those are the number of stages that I'll work on those 5 stages over the course of this week.
I saw 4.
And then the 5th is generative.
Okay.
That we started with. So are you convinced? Does it seem true enough?
What I'm interested in is how social dynamics, maybe even family unit dynamics, if you're not looking at kids, how that plays in. Because often it seems like in a partnership, a couple, if you have one spouse that veers towards rebel producer stage, the other one might be at peacekeeper stage. I mean, there might be some, does that fit into this model?
Yeah, I think it does, in the sense that we tend to two things. We have a default mode, right, most of us, and mine is peacekeeping.
Yeah.
Right? My wife's is rebel producing.
Would you agree on that?
She's not here.
Oh.
Yeah, I would. I'm a peacekeeper. I wouldn't say it if she was here. But those are the default modes. Default modes. And in some ways, those are a little counterintuitive to a gendered division of work. But she's the eldest child, and I'm the only son with 4, and the youngest with 4 older sisters.
Right.
So, you know, my job was to make sure everybody got along. So I default to peacekeeping. But and the other, I think, interesting piece is we tend to go to the level of which we meet people at the level they're at. Mm-hmm. And that is, in fact, in leadership stages, in leadership work, I try to say, if you can get people to come up to your level instead of going down to theirs, or even just to understand that if my wife sees me acting as a peacekeeper, she might inquire why, get curious about it instead of judgmental.
Right.
Or if I see her acting as a rebel producer, I'm like, I wonder what I did to trigger that behavior instead of a generative behavior. And, so get curious instead of critical is a principle that I think is worth...
Oh, that is good. Get curious, not critical. That's pretty good.
Worth the price of admission?
Yeah, it was worth the price
of
admission. Exactly.
Thank you. I'm leaving.
We go to 7:15, right?
Yes.
Okay, well then I'll go a little bit into the first stage since we have it.
This is
the enforcer stage. So again, their thinking is episodic, right? So they cannot connect, or they have difficulty connecting one thought to another, one moment to another. Their thinking is more episodic. Again, 0 to 3. Feelings. They are their emotions. They have no relationship to their emotions. They can't say, "Oh, I'm sad. I see that I'm sad." They just are sad, or they just are pissed off, or they just are these things. And again, adults get caught up in this, where they have no relationship to their emotions. They just are them. So if someone is raging, they're usually not thoughtful about it. They're just caught by it. And their needs are safety and survival, which is appropriate for a 0 to 3 year old. May not be appropriate for a 43-year-old.
Or if they're an adult, they just need to vent.
Right, that's right.
Well, we just went through a reduction in force, and this is exactly what it was. Fear for your own, who's next, staying, no matter where you were in that. This is exactly, it was just rah, 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 survival, totally.
Yeah. And depending on how we set up our institutional life, we're more likely to draw these kinds of responses out of people. So if you think about people whose very economic life is on the line, or their life is on the line, they're more likely to respond out of an enforcer mode.
So do they tend not to learn from experience then? Is it too early for them to learn by experience? Is maybe a better way of saying that?
I don't know. I don't know how to answer that, I guess.
I don't know if you can. I mean, I noticed with my daughter, when she is so caught up in that, it's almost like there's no capacity to get anywhere with her. It just has to, the emotions have to be released, and then...
Right.
But
they must learn, right? Or otherwise they can't develop out of this stage. So they must be building. There must be some notion of building capacities, even in this stage.
Yeah.
So how do they get what they want? They can play. So they get joy out of playing. Or they fight and fight.
Well,
and
when they learn, at that age, they're learning how to verbalize. So they're learning that tool.
Right.
In that time. So.
Yeah. They are learning language. I mean, that's coming around too, right? If I remember, I can barely remember. I'm stressed, tired, and anxious.
Graham?
Yes, sir?
I was just going to say, well, isn't it at this sort of stage that what starts to happen next is categorical thinking begins to develop, so that kids separate, then you get boys and girls, which then leads to you're able to say, so-and-so is happy or so-and-so is sad. And you see little kids, pointing at babies saying, she's sad, which seems to be the beginning of that sort of being able to reflect on or move past just being the emotion, but place it in a category, which is that kind of reflective move.
And where do you think, at what age would you suggest that happens?
I don't know. I was just wondering if that you were talking about, how do you move past that?
That
it's there's a cognitive developmental piece that's also at work.
Right.
Well, that's in relationship to emotions.
Well, I sure hope you guys work this out so I can move on.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Well, no. Well, you said 3.
Well, I do childcare, and I've been doing it for 13 years. And once they can verbalize an emotion, they aren't as emotionally volatile themselves.
Right. Well, does this seem right to you then, someone who's worked with kids for 13 years?
Yeah. But I think about adults, as you say, and if you have a big enough shock, you're kind of jolted into this place.
I've been in that
place.
I walked out of a meeting one time. Only time I've ever walked out of a meeting in my life, and I started getting that primal. It was such a primal response, and I just like walked out.
You flight.
That was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's a raging, and you can't stop it. You can even see it happening within yourself.
Well, it's only a model, but one of the things I like about it is it helps me think about, you know, I'm trying to remember the movie, but the movie about Rwanda, Hotel Rwanda.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you see what human beings are capable of doing to one another,
exactly.
And I'm just not willing to say that the reason we don't do that to one another is because we're better. I'm just not willing to say that. But this model gives me a sense that, no, the reason that they do that to one another is because their primary needs are so much up,
right.
And we have the luxury, most of us,
right.
Not having those up for grabs. So I find that a helpful way of thinking about both sin and also not being racist and superior. And particularly when you think about all the ways in which all the forces that go into the conditions of people's lives that make them or invite them to react out of an enforcer stage rather than more generative.
Well, and one parallel to that is the same time that stuff is happening in Rwanda, black, African, primitive, etc., it was happening in Bosnia. Mm-hmm. And the same phenomenon.
And it's happening in America.
It's happening what?
It has happened in America.
Right. Well, I think this is the presentation for today, and then tomorrow we can talk, if you come back, about some of the other stages.
Mm-hmm.
And then to think, too, I'm really interested in this notion of commitment. To what can we be committed? And what is the depth and power of our commitment? And I want to suggest, and this is that depending on where we are in our developmental moment, that our commitment is commensurate with that. So a child can only be committed to their own ends at this stage, 0 to 3. They can't really be committed to the family, right? They can't be committed to their brothers or sisters. They're committed to their own ends, and that's appropriate. But again, an adult who cannot sustain any kind of commitment, we consider it kind of pathological. And I want to suggest they're working out of an enforcer stage. But if we go to scorekeeping, we see another kind of commitment. Well, yeah, they can be committed as long as their needs are being met,
right.
As long as it's a quid pro quo kind of commitment. And so I'm trying to develop, through this stage model, a deeper understanding of commitment, and that we may be able to talk about what would a generative commitment look like. And I want to suggest a generative commitment is committed to doing what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, with whom it needs to be done. And that's easier said than done. Because we get triggered back, you know, I don't want to do it with you because I might not look good, or you know, it might create conflict, or it could be a whole host of reasons we don't want to be fully committed.
Yeah, I'm always giving and I'm never getting, you know, I'm always serving others, and how come I'm the one that always completes this? That resentment. That's interesting.
Well, thanks for trying out your headlines with me, the few that did. Any others headlines? Well, now that we've got to know each other and are comfortable.
Can you show us again your definition of generator?
Sure. So I divided it out here in terms of thinking, feeling, needs, how they get their needs met, or power, and I started to go into the question of commitment. What's the quality and nature of their commitment, or of generative commitment? So again, thinking, it's a both and rather than an either or. feeling, it's empathetic, and it is sort of authentic, where again, a peacekeepers tend not to be, you feel like sometimes they're telling you what you want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
They're not giving you their true feelings.
Yeah.
And especially anger or gets masked. I don't think I've ever said I'm angry. I've often said I'm frustrated. And then the needs are not about survival, right? They're not about getting their sense of worth, right? Which is really the middle, the need of a scorekeeper. It's not about belonging, which is the needs of a peacekeeper, right? A teenager. They want to belong to the group. It's not about competence, which is the needs of a fellow producer. It's about meaning and purpose. So you can see it's a kind of post-ego set of needs. And then power, how do they leverage in the world? Not by manipulation, not by force, but by engagement, partnership, acceptance of what's real, shared purpose.
Couldn't make any analysis of America's current political situation, could you?
Yes.
The decider.
The decider.
The decider?
Enforcer decider.
But you do, I mean, it is interesting to think how quickly we gave up on generative values when our survival was mm-hmm. even a little bit at stake.
Yeah,
I would suggest.
Or even if you suggest that our survival is at stake, it becomes a political mechanism by which you can get power and give up the other values.
I'm going to close this.
Yes. Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.